Rebecca Wall, Vice President of the Commission. With us arriving soon will be Tony Olson, our President. We have to my left Sid Olson, Secretary, Ann Spangler to my right, General Counsel, Guy Payne, Assistant General Manager of Distribution and Engineering, Allison Morrison, Assistant Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stoltzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices. This session is for the Board, CEO, General Manager, or his designee, to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PUD staff. We'll now turn the meeting over to our temporary CEO, Guy Payne. Welcome.
Thank you, Commissioner Wolf. We'll start out with our media update. Julie Dunningham.
Good morning, Commissioners. Happy Public Power Week. This is the week we honor public power across the country. We are one of the top size utilities. I like to think we're the best one of all, but we're at least within the top 11. So along with, we kicked Public Power Week off with an EV event this weekend, which was so much fun. We had so many interesting cars out there. I know Commissioner Wolf was there as well, getting to see. We had a Rivian truck and a Lightning truck, and I can't imagine that every person on the planet isn't going to. It lifts up and dumps it all out, and it's super cool. And a Genesis, which is a brand new car, that's a 2023 Genesis out there. So it was fun. It was a good event. Our next event is Run for Warmth. It's next weekend, or the weekend after, the 15th. So looks like the weather's going to hold up for that as well.
And the electric buses were quite a hit.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was a very fun event.
Very successful.
And kudos go out to Hillary Olson and Laura Zorich and the teams that assisted them, because we really didn't know how it would be received, and it went really well.
Fun.
Do it again in the spring.
Wonderful. So glad you did that.
Yeah, it was really fun. So other things going on. You probably saw, yes, we were part of a story in the Herald this weekend, a page that actually was done by Zachariah Bryan. He has left the Herald since then. He's with, but he had started that story. That story was also in Crosscut. So some attention happening with that. We had media attention from our EV car show. New York Vinny interviewed Aaron Swaney on Saturday morning talking about it. So that was a fun piece that happened with that. Aaron and Scott Gibson have worked with Hitachi to get a story on the microgrid in T&D Press. That will be coming out. I didn't have a copy of it, or I would have brought that along. Aaron and Bob Anderson worked with a reporter from Crosscut on a story about our Mesa 2 project and all of the issues at Uni Energy. That's with Crosscut. We were featured in a Stanwood Camino News article talking about replanting trees we took out, making room for a second transmission line project. We worked with the Herald and Seattle Times reporters to talk about why power was cut to a section near the recent Bolt fire, which actually is still going on. I don't know if they've reopened the highway again or not. That was talked about in the Everett Herald and Seattle Times. Our press release on supply chain issues, talking about why we have some of the delays on our connect up, was picked up and clearing up in the Mukilteo Beacon. We had a Herald column in September talking about 4 questions to consider before you go solar in the Everett Herald. And that we did our power talk on and was our most popular one so far. That solar attracts a lot of people. Now this week, our power talk will be on some of our new tools. We're getting an app and all of the fun things you can do in My Snowpud and the things that the team there is bringing to us. So hoping we'll get a good attendance on that as well. NPR did a story on our Qualco project, the future renewable energy may lie in organic waste. That was on KUOW. And then in some other things that have been happening, Kelly Stickney helped Kim's group by filling in for representing us during a media call set up by Representative Del Benny's office to talk about the Inflation Reduction Act. So it was nice to get to do that with Kim's group sweat in. Kelly also attended the Governor's Safety Conference and for the recognition on Bill Greenfield and Tommy O'Brien, which was very cool and has been picked up in the Learning Up and WPPA Daily Tribunes and My Edmonds News so far. So really great recognition for two very regular guys getting some attention. Aaron and Kevin Lavering are working with APPA Magazine on a story about utilities that are dealing with smart grid supply issues. And then two things on two currents. The APPA Public Power Current had us a photo of us on the on their top on our work at Walter E. Hall Park on the solar recently. And then Currents is our own Current is in the mail. So everyone should receive that now. It's a great fall issue, charging into fall, has lots of good information about all the many, many things that we have going. That's all I got, except I personally want to do a public thank you to Anne. Anne learned so much from you. I will miss you so much, but I know I'll get to see you in our private life. I'm going to make it one of my missions to make sure I don't lose contact with you. So thank you so much. It's going to be weird not having you here for me. Thank you.
Really, would it be possible to get a link to that KUOW?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay.
I'll look for you.
Thank you, Julie. Next, we have our interlocal agreement, Snohomish County Bridge 102 replacement with Brentwood.
Good morning, Commissioners. Brentwood, AGM of the Water Utility. Just here to give a quick update on an interlocal agreement that we have with Snohomish County. So if you've been out north of Granite Falls, kind of northeast of Granite Falls, it's a really tall bridge, Bridge 102, a couple miles outside of the city limits itself. I remember when this bridge, when the water main went over this bridge in 1995, watching that construction. It's a very tall bridge. It's very scary. It was scary to watch the original main go on that bridge. So Snohomish County is slated to replace that bridge sometime in 2025. Again, we have an insulated 12-inch pipe that goes over that, serving about 300 customers, kind of north or east of the bridge. So the county's bridge replacement project, along with our franchise permit with Snohomish County, will require us to replace that main. So we're going to be working with Snohomish County on the design, installation of a new main on the new bridge, and then demolition of the old main off the old bridge to keep everyone in service. The estimate for the overall project is about $611,000. Again, it's slated for starting design kind of this year into next year, and then construction in 2025. The next steps would be coming back to you in the next meeting with a request to approval of an authorization, a resolution authorizing the CEO, general manager, to execute an interlocal agreement with Snohomish County regarding the design and replacement of the water facilities impacted by their project. Again, Q4 2022 through 2024, project design and coordination. We'll work with Snohomish County on that. In 2025 sometime. Right now, it's looking like project construction. Any questions?
I have one. Would RPUD be engaged in the financial negotiations talks, or would the county be determining that? And we just have to say okay or no. How would that work?
So typically on interlocal will be part of their contract, so there'll be bid items in their contract related to the water work. And we pay those portions of the fee. So it will be publicly bid, and then we'll see the results and work with that to pay.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
I have no questions.
Thank you, Grant. Next, we have Kelsey Lewis with the Clean Buildings Accelerator Agreement.
Good morning, Commissioners. As Guy mentioned, I'm Kelsey. I'm a program manager in energy services. I'm also joined by my colleague, Rob McManus, a key account manager in energy services. And today, we're here to talk to you about a new agreement for our Clean Buildings Accelerator Program. It's just information today, so no action is required, but we're preparing a resolution for the next commission meeting on October 18th. We want this to be conversational, so please feel free to interrupt us with any questions you might have. So I'll start with a little bit of history. Back in 2019, House Bill 1257 was passed into law to become the Clean Buildings Performance Standard, or the Clean Buildings Law. Buildings are the second largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in Washington state. So the objective of this law is really to cost-effectively reduce greenhouse gas emissions, as buildings are the largest or most rapidly growing source of greenhouse gas emissions in the state. Building owners are responsible for compliance. So the law was passed in 2019, and then building owners were notified by a letter from the Department of Commerce in 2021.
Interesting. If you go back to that slide, it's almost double in the 25 years for buildings.
Yeah, from 1990 to 2015, it's really rapidly increased. And this is data from the Department of Commerce.
It's astonishing.
Some basics of the law are that a building owner needs to calculate their energy use index, or their EUI, by uploading data into Energy Star Portfolio Manager. And then the building owner needs to meet certain energy use index targets, or EUITs, established by Commerce based on the building type. So you'll hear a lot about benchmarking. It's a key feature of the law. And so if your target is at a certain level, let's say 50, if you're over that target, you're out of compliance. So you want to be at or below target to comply with the law. So there's different deadlines for compliance based on the size of the building. So for 220,000 square feet and above, that date is June of 2026. For 90 to 220,000, it's 2027, and then 50,000 to 90,000, it's 2028. So this impacts buildings that are 50,000 square feet and larger. Realistically though, those requirements need to be operationalized 1 year before the deadline. So we're really looking at 2025, 2026, and 2027. For those largest buildings, 2025 is only 2.5 years away, and there's a lot of aspects of the law. So we're seeing this as we want to get our foot in the door early so that customers don't come to us last minute saying, oh my gosh, how do we handle this? And there are some teeth to the law. So there's penalties ranging from 20 cents to a dollar per square foot. That depends on whether or not the building has a mitigation plan, or if they're just saying, okay, we'll take the hit. So for large buildings, that's potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars in penalties that we want to help our customers avoid.
Kelsey, is there any exceptions? Are all buildings these sizes?
No, there are exceptions if they're manufacturing, if they're multifamily, parking garages. It depends on their use.
Schools, hospitals have to comply?
Yes, schools and hospitals, municipalities all need to comply. Commerce is making some exceptions for schools, so they're allowing them to apply as a campus. That sometimes helps with not needing to do submetering. So I feel that Commerce has been, you know, keeping track on what the challenges have been, and within reason, making adjustments.
Even if a building's 100 years old, if it happens to be this size, it's
it needs to be compliance. Yeah.
Interesting.
There's also an early adopter incentive program. So buildings above 50,000 square feet that are 15 points above their target are eligible for an 85 cent per square foot incentive if they bring their building into compliance. So if you show that you're way above target and you come into compliance, you can get this incentive. And this is where the utility comes in, because we actually pay that incentive, and then we're reimbursed with a tax credit for public utility taxes. So you can see this law comes, oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. I do have a question, but I'm interested.
So this law does come with both a carrot and a stick.
Yeah.
We're really looking at this as an opportunity, because the commercial market has been somewhat challenging because there's split incentives. The owner owns the building, but they don't necessarily always pay the utility bill. So they're not necessarily incentivized to invest in energy efficiency. And then the tenants, they don't own the building, so they are not incentivized, or they might not have the resources. So we're seeing this as an opportunity to make headway in this market segment.
Okay, I think that's great, but I
on slide, the previous slide, with the penalties, who is the stick?
That would be the Department of Commerce.
It's not us.
It's not us.
Okay, we're out.
No, we just get to give out the incentives, unfortunately. That's a great question.
We write it on our horse or our broom.
I think that's great, but I was also thinking if they were expecting utilities to manage that, that wouldn't be a very good PR.
Fortunately not.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Do we have any idea, well, I'm sure we have an idea, how many square feet are in our buildings?
We are over 50,000 square feet, and I'm not exactly sure of the number, but we are working on recruiting snow put facilities for the next cohort with this agreement.
Thank you.
So I want to give a rundown just of the full picture of requirements of the law. So sites need to designate an energy manager and other roles. They need to benchmark their performance with their EUI and Energy Star, develop an energy management plan and an operation and maintenance program, comply with the target, and then engage and educate occupants. So it's not just bringing your building into performance, it's documentation, it's training. And so I'm going to pass it over to Rob to talk a little bit about how we make an investment to help our customers navigate this law over the last year.
Good morning, I'm Rob McManus with our Key Accounts Group. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Clean Buildings Accelerator. We first became interested in this and working with our partner, PSC. We have a very close working relationship with our energy efficiency group at PSC. They launched an accelerator a year before with Stillwater. We've been watching that very closely. It was very successful. So we decided that this would be something that our customers would also benefit from, so we decided to launch a pilot in 2022. It has been difficult since the law passed in 2019 to be able to educate and to get customers interested and knowledgeable about this. Commerce is in the process of putting together all the rules, and those really weren't clear. In 20, COVID rolled around, businesses really, their focus turned into much more in the moment. That the dates are really out there in the future, so a lot of companies just put those off. But we're getting interest now. Letters went out last year to all the building owners, and that has burned an awful lot of interest in the program and getting people into compliance. So we launched ours in March of this year. We had 8 participants in that. They've been fully engaged. I'll talk a little bit about the timeline for our accelerator here in a couple of slides. But through these through the initial phase of this in our pilot, we've developed over 120 project pipelines, projects that are in the pipeline. Now, these are from no cost provisions all the way up to some fairly significant capital projects. But, for 8 participants, they have 120 different ways that they can change their building to become in compliance. They've been very happy with that, and we're estimating about 340,000 kilowatt hour savings as a result of that. Here's an overview of the program itself. It's no cost to participants. We wanted to make sure that we minimize the cost to them. They're going to be paying some fairly significant dollars to bring the buildings up to compliance, so it was important for us to gain their trust and to make sure that we're giving information at no cost. The purpose of this was to do 2 things, really, from as far as an education standpoint. It was to educate not only the building owners, but also PD employees. We're going to know we're going to be talking with a lot of customers over the next 3 or 4 or 5 years. And part of that conversation needs to be from an informed standpoint. So we wanted to educate ourselves as well. Commerce is coming out with new rules almost every day, and working with Stillwater, they've got their pulse on what's going on in commerce. They have contacts there, so they're keeping us up to speed on what the current rules are that are coming out of commerce. Like Kelsey was talking about with the some of the changes to the schools.
Question. It's kind of a question, it's kind of a comment. I would think that the U.S. government would have some programs to help pay for this, and maybe state.
This is a state law.
But no federal money could be.
I think so. Kelsey, do you want?
No, not that I know of.
Okay. Because I know there's federal money for a lot of things that are in state or local. But okay, at least.
Yes, there was some state money involved with the early adopter program.
Uh-huh.
But nothing that we're federal.
Maybe that will be in the future.
But that's why it's really important for us to keep our finger on the pulse of what's happening so that we can provide as many opportunities for our customers to be able to fund some of the compliance costs for this.
Rob, I have another question on this slide. Understanding rules, how to comes out of commerce. And will we be making an effort to try to, because we have building owners at all different ends of the spectrum in terms of even understanding the basics of the industry. So, you know, step it down, but well, no, simplify it so that all of our commercial customers can easily understand.
That's our goal. Absolutely. Okay, well, I'm going to talk a little bit about that on the next slide. I'll go into some of the specifics of how we're working with our customers.
Okay.
Overall, education is a big part of this, and really our customers understanding where they sit right now. That's part of the benchmarking. Understanding whether you're in really good shape, and some of these owners are. They're already are meeting compliance currently. Others have a lot of work to do. You can't really start your journey until you know where you are. A big part of this is the benchmarking and helping them identify some areas where they can save energy and comply with the law. The program elements, there's four parts of it: group workshops, coaching calls, energy scans, and a series of templates and guides. And that's really where we get into the details with our customers. Last week we had a group workshop. It was very successful. The participants were there. There's a lot of peer-to-peer sharing, which is really, really important. What problems are you having? What are you finding works well? All the calls, we have PUD employees that are there providing guidance and working with our customers. Group workshops are a wonderful place to talk openly and as a group. The coaching calls and the energy scans, those are very personal. So those are calls directly with individual customers. And again, the PUD employees do participate in that. As key account manager, I participate in the calls with the three of the customers. My customers are in that first cohort. I participate in all the calls. They appreciate that. It really gives us an opportunity to better understand their business and to assist them. The coaching calls will over some very specific things. You're talking about Commissioner Olson. That's where we get down to the nitty gritty. In fact, we had a coaching call last week as well with one of our customers. They were very frustrated because they couldn't figure out their EUIs. The Energy Star portfolio manager was not, was giving them a very wrong 0.5 EUI, and they knew that wasn't right. Within 5 minutes, Stillwater had figured out there was a gap in their data. And so they went from frustrated and unhappy, and I know she spent hours and hours trying to figure that out on her own, because she's just that type of person. Within 5 minutes, Stillwater had it figured out. So there, and she was elated. Sent me a note later, Rob, this was really great. Thank you very much. I'm glad we participated. So the.
Do you think we'll have a dashboard for monitoring a lot, you know, as we go forward?
That's a great idea. We don't have one set up yet.
I'm sure Kelsey would love to do that.
She's vigorously writing that down. No, that's a really good idea. It'd be nice to, if nothing else, to be able to keep track of how many kilowatt hours are saved and keep it at a higher level.
But this is a state program, so I'm sure the state has some kind of dashboard for compliance.
They have a They have an online portal, but as far as we have heard, nothing where we can see what's been done across the state, but I'm sure, hopefully that's something they're working on it. We're also working internally on our customer relationship manager, because we're also trying to manage who have we reached out to, what do they know, how have they participated.
So here's the program timeline for a typical cohort. There's a fairly intense period, that first 4 months, we call it the sprint period. We go through, we have group conversations at least once a month. They're monthly coaching calls as well. So there's 2 to 3 times per month we're actually touching the customer and working with the customer. And that's getting them familiar with Energy Star Portfolio Manager, setting up their accounts, benchmarking their buildings, really doing an intense education period during that first 4 months.
I like the word intense.
It really has to be.
Because you build relationships, but you also build trust.
Exactly.
And, maybe a state program, but they're all customers.
Right, and we fully expect to be holding their hands as they go through this and helping them all along the way. This is a huge lift. It's very important from an energy saving standpoint, but it is a big lift. 100-year-old buildings that are going to take an awful lot of work. The more help we get our customers along the way, the better off they're going to be. But very intense first 4 months, and then we take a step back. We allow them to start to work on their own programs, but we do have check-ins, quarterly check-ins. We had one of those engagements here recently, a seven-month check-in with our first cohort, our pilot cohort. The whole cohort program is about 16 months long. We're certainly available to work with them as beyond that. We haven't quite gotten there yet with our first pilot group to see what their needs are going to be, but we're certainly available after that as well. This is just one participant feedback. Word of Everett, they were very pleased. I won't read it in front of you, but they were very pleased with the resources and the clarity and the tools and the resources. So it's very gotten very positive feedback so far. This next slide, we'll pass it back over to Kelsey.
Thank you, Rob. So, since we've launched our cohort, we're looking into the future. We have more than 500 buildings in our service territory that will need to come into compliance. And as I mentioned, we really want to get ahead of that last minute rush and be there to provide proactive customer service. And we're also looking at some of our other programs that might be a good fit for these customers. We have an RFP out right now for a commercial strategic energy management program. We currently have an industrial SEM program. But we want to launch a commercial one, and we surveyed our current pilot participants, and almost all of them said they'd be interested in joining. And that typically takes 6 to 12 months to recruit for, so it sets up a really nice pipeline of potential participants. And as I mentioned before, this is a tough segment for us to connect with sometimes, so it allows us to create those connections and just introduce them to other programs.
Of the 500 plus buildings, would there be any idea what amount or percentage might not be in compliance?
We don't know until we look at their EUI and they actually do the benchmarking.
How about the ones in the pilot? How many of them need to do something too?
So, funnier enough, 8 of them, I think only half of them have completed benchmarking because of the data challenges. And from what I can remember, we have several that are in compliance or under target. That was a pleasant surprise. I think we have 1 or 2 that are significantly over target and might be candidates for the early adopter incentive, but most of them have been under target.
Are the gas utilities involved with this as well, or?
I'm not familiar with gas utility.
Is he?
Yeah.
Cascade or
sorry, I heard gas.
Natural gas, right.
So we partner with PSC in this program since they also have a contract with Stillwater. So one of their energy engineers will be on the energy scan. And then we haven't partnered with Cascade Natural Gas yet, but to not. So in terms of this agreement, we are wanting to launch 4 cohorts in the next 3 years. So we're We're looking at a new cohort every 6 months. And the total cost ranges depending on the number of buildings. So between $296,000 to $360,000 for that four cohort contract.
And those are reimbursable debt as Catholic tax credit?
No, so that is the cost for running the program with Stillwater. And then the early adopter incentive is separate from that.
Okay.
We've learned a lot from our pilot that we want to apply to these future cohorts. One being that for large buildings with several tenants, the building owner is responsible for compliance, but they don't see the energy data and we can't just give it to them. We have to aggregate it for them so that they don't know which tenant is using how much, but they know the overall building. So that is a lot of work internally to kind of iron out what can be a real mess. So we're working to figure out how we're going to do that for all the buildings in our service territory. And Energy Star has taken a lot longer than I expected. So we're devoting future cohorts to spending more time on that up front, because once you know your EUI, then you have a better picture of what you need to do long term. And as Rob mentioned, we really see the value in working with Stillwater because they have the expertise and knowing the daily changes of the lot, and then we're able to focus on that relationship with the customer, but know that we can provide the most accurate, up-to-date information.
Excuse me, I have one other question. Thank you for clarifying what those dollars were linked to. Do we have a contract with Coldwater?
We have a contract with Stillwater right
Stillwater,
now for yeah. our pilot, yes.
And then that will extend into ongoing work with?
We would sign a new contract for this set of cohorts.
Thank you.
Okay. And so at the next commission meeting on October 18th, we'll be asking for a resolution to sign the contract. And we're really excited about getting started. So that would go into effect on October 19th.
This is a huge plus, this program. And I think however we can share this information with the public, the more the better, because this is huge. I mean, if we reach our goal. And so thank you for your work on it. I think you're going to have a lot of interesting challenges coming up.
Yeah.
You're going to be working hard. And so thank you in advance.
I've got a quick question. So as we go through this, are we going to, if we're helping customers keep their goals to energy goals to reduce their buildings' carbon footprint, are we also going to be working with them on demand response options or other kinds of programs that we may have as well, off-peak usage, this kind of thing?
Yeah, maybe Rob can speak to that more, but typically when we develop that relationship, we use that to offer them additional programs.
I just want to clarify something with the commissioners. Are we requesting that they build the dashboard? I'm not interested in
because I don't know what information to ask. No, it's just a question.
Okay.
To see if there might be plans for that.
I think we probably track all the savings we get from our energy.
We definitely track all the savings.
Yeah.
We just don't have something separate that shows just for clean buildings.
Yeah. I just have a couple of closing questions to clarify. Compliance, ongoing compliance. They achieved the goal and there's some kind of compliance to somebody that they have to.
Yeah, that's a great question. So compliance happens every 5 years. So they submit their documents to show that they have their energy management plan and that they're hitting their EUIT. And then the next 5 years, they have to do it again. That means that if they're incurring penalties, they can also incur them at the next 5 years.
Okay, and that's all with Commerce.
Yeah.
Okay.
The early adopter incentive is only available until the funds are depleted.
Do we have any idea? Well, you don't know the volume, so there's
a $75 million pot of funds.
Okay, is that for the entire state?
Yes.
Okay. And one other thing, this is really complex. And I'm excited. I think it's it. But it, you know, I just kind of care here and it's too clear. And for me, on top of it all, the most important is that we retain the trust of our customers. And that's going to be an interesting, it'll just make it more complex for us, I think. Working through the state and probably you wouldn't have an incentive program if you weren't having great cooperation. And so this will be a challenge, and I know you can do it, but
yeah, we're looking at it as an opportunity. And the last
that's true. Absolutely. And when I read, you know, we get in there, and there's so many other things that we can offer that helps the customer. But I just, in terms of the back room and work, extensive and complicated, complex. And I commend you for taking it on.
Thank you.
No, just a comment. It's a great opportunity for us to use our energy. I was surprised the legislature told us it's like changing codes after the fact. It's not quite code, but it's an interesting way it's getting very close to our investment challenge.
Yeah.
What is Stillwater? All I know is it's a river in Montana.
They're located out of Bend, Oregon.
Oh, okay.
But they're working with several utilities in Washington State on this law.
Okay, thank you. But we have an individual contract. It's not a contract.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you, commissioners.
Thank you, Kelsey and Rob. Next, we have Peter Dauenauer with the semiannual 2022 Energy Risk Management Report.
Good morning, Commissioner. Maybe Brian Booth.
I would like to give Peter a quick introduction. I'm Brian Booth, the Senior Manager of Rates, Economics, and Energy Risk Management here at the PUD. If you want to embarrass him for just a moment, you may have already known he has a Master's in Economics from the University of Amsterdam. He's recently completed his PhD in Electrical Engineering at the University of Strathclyde. So please humiliate him at every possible opportunity.
Congratulations, Dr. Dauenauer.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Brian. I should update those slides now. I guess I get to put a few more letters in there. Good morning, commissioners. Peter Dauenauer here. And as Brian said, so I'll be delivering this presentation about our semi-annual ERMC report. So got a few slides here for you. Going to go through some background on the ERMC. Some sort of ERMC 101 kind of concepts, and then get into how the year's gone so far. So as far as this presentation, like I said, we're going to be doing a report on the energy risk considerations and actions of the ERMC over the last period, and this is informational only. Just for your recall here, these were some of our last meetings. The last one was held way back in January, start of this year. That was for the Q4 2021 quarterly risk report. So we've got a few months in between then and now. Our agenda is to, as I said, go through the background and some of the fundamentals of energy risk, talk about the sources of risk, and then report on the 2022 year-to-date risk itself, and then have a look at how things are looking for the rest of the year. So a little background, of course, the PUD staff make our best efforts to anticipate both the consumption of electric power by its customers and the supply of electric power available. The district then engages in transactions in order to meet customer needs in a dependable, safe, and responsible manner. These transactions include buying, selling, and scheduling of electric power options for electric power and other energy commodities as necessary to load and mitigate risk. Some of our key management strategies are to keep our market position near neutral in the short term. That's up to the 30 months, which is within our horizon that we look at with ERMC, and keep our exposure to market prices below limits. Our limits are set so that we do not have to have any more than a 3% rate increase as a result of any market movements. And we define and update uncertainties related to generation load market prices quite frequently. And then we also, of course, transact our operations over time in order to average out some of the market variations as well as using our glide path. Here's a sense of the hydro slice variability. This is from 2012 through 2021, May 2021. You see here that over any given month, there's quite a lot of variability that we see in slice. We've talked about this many times, but in particular in the February through June period, quite a bit of variation depending on when the runoff is occurring and how the weather outlook has been for that year. Then we often see that smaller bands of potential hydro variability in September, sort of a September, October, November timeframe. At the same time, we see temperature variation. So this is looking back from 1942 to 2017, but you can see the ranges of temperature we see. Of course, this is quite related to our load, which we have in the slide coming up. So we have to provide for these potential temperature and loads scenarios on a daily basis. One part of the load that we particularly look at is the heating degree days. So when we are thinking about the winter time and the winter variability, it's really driven off of our heating degree days. And this is a metric that's based off of the average daily temperature difference from 60 degrees. And so when we see those heating degree days going up, meaning we see colder and colder days, we start to see more and more load during our winter time. So this kind of gives you a range of the heating degree days that we've seen over that same 1942 to 2017. Period. As a result of that, we have load variability, and this shows our loads ranges for, by month, 1998 to 2018. The black line being our P50, our median load, and the orange line being P25 to P75. So half the time, it's in between those orange lines, and then the kind of light green color is 95 and P5, so that would mean that 90% of the time our loads are within those ranges. Most of the time, we're aiming for that black line. At times, as we get closer and closer to the month at hand, we have to start shoring up our position so that we are addressing what our actual load expectations are. Wind variability, only one band on this one, but this is taken from 2021 as well. So if we take our wind at that time, you can see that times PD has had quite a bit of range for wind in any given month. So putting all these things together, it means that we need to develop a kind of a target position that we can carry into each month. So this is a sort of deliberate extra amount of length that we bring in to ensure that we don't get caught surprisingly short in an expensive market, and we kind of project this out over the next 30 months. It's based off of our hydro or wind and our load historical volatility, and then we also look at adding in a little extra during the months where there's some concerns about regional generation sufficiency. This table here is the combination of those things. So each one of these numbers is an average megawatts value of the type of variability and how that translates to a monthly target of what we should be bringing into the month. Typically, typically it's the combination of load and wind. You can see where in the column where it says or market, where this is higher than some of that load and wind risk, we bring that forward. So to give you an example, I see July and August. That saying is that typically our load and wind risk is not particularly that high during July and August. However, we have concerns in the market, so we carry a little bit more of that. Yes?
I don't know if this is part of your work, but it seems to me that we can reduce what we try to reduce load in many ways. So how does that interface with all of this? Or is it too early to ask that question? Because, you know, for example, we don't have an air conditioner. We have a way to manage our cooling without an air conditioner in our house. And so, you know, I hang my clothes on the line, don't use the dryer very much. Things like that that we can do on the conservation side and electrical efficiency.
Sure.
I just don't know how we can reduce our load. It seems like we're trying to meet load, but at the same time, we're trying to reduce load. So
absolutely.
Thanks. Complicated to me.
No, thanks for the question, Commissioner Wolf. I think you know, what we do on this side, the sort of interaction here is we're constantly updating our load forecast for what we're actually seeing. And it's true that we are targeting and going after conservation at the same time of having to deal with the practical reality of you need to keep the lights on at all times. So no matter what any one person might do, or we might as a county do together, we still have to meet that load. So what we do is we look at historical loads, and we also project what we think we're going to see in the future. We also need to keep in mind that on any one day might be different from the next day. And so when we have these temperature variations, our heat dome last year was a great example. What is potential is often changing too, and we need to apply for that potential. Same time, looking at new tools that we can bring into the mix, such as time dynamic rates to help people get the right incentives to shift load during peaks. So on this side of it, when we're thinking about risk, what we're often doing, I guess, is to update our load forecast so that we are bringing in what's actually happening and forecasting is going to happen as much as best as possible.
So that's interesting. It's very interesting how we can make those work together or help those work together.
Yeah, I think we're going to hear quite a bit more about the load forecast and a couple more presentations, so hang on to your seats. That should be fun.
I will.
So one area which we are often looking at as kind of a gauge for market prices and the volatility and even the amount of financial risk that we're taking on is heat rates. So just talk to you briefly about heat rates. What this is a metric, 1 million British thermal units, MBBTU, divided by the megawatt hours. And so this is something that you can relate to a generating facility. And it basically shows the efficiency of converting fossil fuel, like chemical energy, into a electrical energy. And you know, we're really looking for lower, more efficient generating units because this requires less of these fossil fuels towards electricity. Another thing that we look at the same time are implied heat rates. Which is, if we're looking at the market, we see the energy prices, which are in dollars per megawatt hour. And they look at the natural gas prices, and we compare these two, we get a implied heat rate. And it reveals at that moment in time which one of those generating units each have these heat rates are rational to actually run. The implied heat rates suggest more costly peaking units are driving the market prices as a heat in the gas markets for fuel. So as an example, if you look at the EAI, Energy Information Administration, the range of heat rates you see, a simple cycle gas turbine is around 1300 heat rates, reciprocating gas engine 10,000, and combined cycle gas turbines around 9,600. If you look at Washington State, and you start putting together all the fossil generation all stack here from the lowest heat rate to the highest heat rate, and the megawatts each one of those generating units can provide, you can build a curve like this. So it's going to make sense when we look at a day-to-day or on the head or whatever period we're looking at to obviously run those units that are lower down in that stack, because it's economically irrational to do so. So those more efficient combined cycles units are down at the bottom are most often dispatched and are kind of driving that price. What you'll notice is on the right-hand side of that graph, it starts sloping up pretty quick. At that point, those more efficient sort of peaking units are coming online, typically competing for these higher priced gas, driving the market through that point. It's at that time where we, you know, looking at the market and it's usually more expensive, we're trying to avoid having supply in those markets.
Yeah, just to clarify for any audience, we don't have any gas generation. You're modeling this so you can understand how the market will respond.
Right. That's correct. We don't have any gas generating units. However, we interact in a market that does,
right.
And so the price of that market is what we're trying to model through this. This graph shows you kind of a brief window in time, looking at a number of months and looking at October 21. In particular, what it's doing is showing you the implied heat rates based off of the power prices and gas prices over that time. And so each one of those points moving from left to right are different. We're looking at different prices for gas and power. Now I've set it to an index being 100 at the start of this, which is October 1st, instead of using the actual prices, just so we can see how these prices move over time. And you can see they're often kind of shifting every day a little bit. In this particular period here, we see quite a few months, about 6 months or so, where it's pretty similar power and gas prices until about end of April. Power prices are starting to outpace gas. You can see the implied heat rates going up at that time too. So this is kind of an indication when we would expect to see power prices being sort of driven a lot by the heat rate and therefore the gas prices that we see. So this is something we're all often kind of looking at to kind of explain why we're seeing high prices.
So I'm a little confused. We're looking at the implied heat rate. Is that just in our territory? Or is that the entire market?
The data comes from MidC, so this is our trading hub.
Okay.
So this would be in much of the Northwest.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. So year to date, in retrospect, and I put a little virtual asterisk there saying this is from April to the end of August. So we're going to look to have a little bit more regular kind of time period as we go forward and get used to this biannual schedule. In terms of supply, through April through August, we can see here our supply with all of our resources, Jackson being black, Lynn being green, Slice being the shaded purple. So that's what I'm going to call it. Over the whole period, pretty average supply period. You see the lower wind output overall being picked up through higher output from Jackson and some of our other small resources. Slice was pretty much on the target. We did have a very low output in April compared to May. June and July, 115% and 107% respectively. During the start of April, we had some pretty cool temperatures, just pointing that out because we'll later see that this is our peak week during this period. As we come into the warmer seasons, kind of would expect it to be earlier part of this time series. So here is our demand over that period as well. You can see that we, first starting with temperature and looking at the historical average temperature, starting to rise over this period, and kind of peaking out in August. We did have a deviation at the start of April, which led to our peak week over the period, which is highlighted there in yellow. And the graph there, fortunately for overall load. So we'll get a little bit more detail about the peak week coming up here. But you can see from the graphs as far as load actual versus load plan, we did have some deviations through August, or I should say April and May, pretty close to the mark in June. And July we had a little bit higher loads. So market prices over this time, so a lot of movement here. The red is the real-time prices, so each one of these is an hourly real-time price that we saw. Day-ahead prices are more in like 12-hour chunks or so. So you can see is over this whole period, we did have quite a bit higher than normal prices, I would say. Maybe not so much in the last year or so, but historically higher than normal prices. Saw a lot of variation with the real-time and day-ahead prices, particularly the end of July and August. We had some peak prices for real-time at $304 per megawatt hour and for day-ahead at $217 per megawatt hour. Here's our peak week demand. So our peak week is during the quarter, I should say, the period here is the largest total load demand during a single week. Also show the market prices during those periods. So in April, prices weren't quite so high as in August, thankfully. So the market prices are on the bottom half, and the load is on the top half of those panels there. And so the week was April 8th through the 14th. We had a maximum 1,087 megawatts, 4:13 at 7 to 8 a.m. Prices over this week peaked on the 14th, and for individual day ahead, it was 146.76, and then real time $1. And over this period, we were net buyer.
So were we a net buyer because we sold some in the past, sold some of our length off, or would we have been net buyer no matter what?
So. We set up the month of April. We do sort of aim for those monthly targets, but we do have some deviations that occur on a week by week basis. So typically, when we get our peak weeks, we're going to be net buyers.
Yeah.
And use the market essentially to kind of fill in that excess need. And you can kind of see the scale there of the buying that we did. So, you know, for the first couple of days, we're actually sellers there. So, and then about 100 megawatts, 100 to 150 megawatts in our day ahead pre-scheduling, where we do a bit more volume than time.
So those are pretty big purchases then.
Define big?
Well, load would probably run 860 watts. 150 is sort of, yeah. Okay. Yes.
I'll defer to Mr. Shapley to talk about that at some point. We also track our forecast errors for our load forecasting. And so adding into this are the right-hand side of the graphs there. And so we're constantly trying to improve our model. You try to track what the source of the error is, oftentimes whether it's a large source. And as we've been seeing changes to usage behaviors as well as new devices coming on, more frequently electrification, you know, we're constantly thinking about tuning them all to make sure that we're reflecting what we expect to happen in the future. So looking at April through August, our modeling error is shown there in orange, and it is in a range of around 30 or so, except for August, 77. We had some weather-related error that same month, going the opposite direction. So our net error was kind of in the range of, we'll call it 10 to 40 over this period. We'll talk a little bit more about the load forecasting in an upcoming presentation. So perhaps I'll leave that out. Okay, now to get into the tests that we saw for the last 6 months or so. Firstly, we look at credit limit. Hold on a second, let me just check out one thing. All right. First, looking at credit limits, so this is looking at our approved trading counterparties, 34 there. We have 34, we have 33 shown, so sort of midway through, we had an additional trading partner. And what you see is about 12 tests for each one of those anonymized trading partners, the black lines, and the maximum exposure over the period is shown with red. Bar, and the last one that we recorded is shown in green. So what this is showing is the current exposure, so it's the cost of all the active transactions at the current market price with each counterparty. We had no exceedances on this test over the quarter. We also look at potential exposure. So if we take those same transactions and we apply a potential price change and having to sort of backfill those purchases on the market, if this particular counterparty went bankrupt, for example. And so this is a kind of a scenario-based test here. Again, see different observations per counterparty over the quarter. We did have one exceedance where we stopped trading with them for a time until prices came less volatile. And essentially, we could begin trading again. So what this test is really driven by is that volatility, that potential change in prices based off of what we see in the market. So that would be our potential exposure over the quarter or over the period. We're also looking at the financial load resource imbalance test. So I think Brian in this one, so I'll give credit for it. The bird in hand is worth two in the bush test. So we have risk limits on this test applied to our net power position when we look at slice at P25 and wind and load at P50. So we set these limits so that we have to incur a higher than 3% rate increase. And for over this period, the no position is allowed to have a market value greater than 7.5 million for any one quarter, or 1 month, 3.6 for any one quarter, so forth. You can read those numbers there. And so over the quarter, we had the limit exceeded three times. So they occurred for a Cal 24 book test that we did. We also had a monthly increase, I should say monthly exceedance for August. And this was corrected shortly thereafter by an updated hydro forecast. So again, you can see kind of the range of where these tests were coming in by those black dots and the maximum. Last test that we did wasn't shown. Our price volatility, so this test looks at our open positions, our net long, I should say net long and short positions, and we apply a change in price, either a expected 1 day or 5 day price change. This is based off of what we're seeing as far as prices for each individual period that we're trading. Over this period, we had two limits that were exceeded here. And these have persisted. One has been Cal 24. It's been on the horizon, as well as the book limit as well. So you can see kind of some of the ranges of the prices, I should say the limits, I should say the tests that we did over the period. So to give you a summary of what happened is exceedances over the period were primarily due to continued elevated prices and volatility that we saw over the period. So I think last time we commission was back in January, and we also reported the same thing pretty much through last year. And you've seen just that continue. Some of the more recent, if you think about the last 6 months, happenings in the world haven't helped with that. So we've seen high prices, high volatility. We got some 2024 coming into our horizon and have quite a bit of structural length that we've been working to reduce our financial exposure to. Finally, we've had some updated favorable water supply forecasts that have been coming through, adding additional length. So we've been responding by transacting primarily on the market to reduce the length, refining some of our methods of evaluating where the value actually is and how we calculate that. And then where we can't solve it immediately, we look at waiting for revised forecasts where higher uncertainty remains on what we expect to have. We'll say that if we compare where we are now with where we were last year and looking at kind of a 2-year forward view, we've transacted around 40 million versus around 20 million last year. So we are actively going about targeting these exceedances and trying to be as proactive as possible here. So this is a figure we're hoping to include in future risk presentations as well, where we are in our four transaction plans.
Sure.
Exceedances. You're working to get them in compliance with the board's policies. Is this telling us in any way that we might need to revisit those policies? The board.
Given
the world it is today, they were set, 15, 20 years?
Yeah, I'll say just two quick things and then I'll see if Brian wants to add anything else here. I do think we are acting within the risk manual to address.
Yeah.
So we are we do have a risk manual that we guide some of our behaviors when we have an exceedance, and we are certainly acting within the range of what we should be doing there. Secondly, the sort of reality of higher prices means that we're going to have more value on that length that we have than we have had typically. So there's an open question on how exactly to address that. We still need to, I think that particular situation suggests that we could get situations where we have, again, higher prices. But I think that's really driving risk that we see.
And now the more I think about it, that actually would require, I don't think, the overall policy that drives this. Is this more internal?
So, Commissioner Olson, can I add one comment?
Oh, thank you.
And that would be, this is Ann Spangler, General Counsel. I think that is a larger conversation because we need to look at what reserves are we carrying on the other side of the spectrum.
Yeah.
So I absolutely agree with Peter that it may be worth looking at that, but we want to look at it holistically with the reserves that we carry. The other thing I wanted to add too, which I appreciate, I wanted to remind the board that whenever we have one of these exceedances, since I see these emails come across my desk, it's a whole committee decision.
Right.
Oh, I know that.
So, you know, there's a lot of care and thought that goes into whether to make those decisions. So, just my two cents.
This gets to exactly a question that's been brewing in my head during this whole presentation is, how do we know we're at the right place for risk and reward? So I certainly understand the risk of holding on to power so you don't have a power market, and the other risk of selling power off, you know, making a profit, and then I understand that. How do we know if the balance is right? I mean, we're on eerily accurate for the year. Our budgeted purchases, our cost of power, is incredibly close to what we budgeted. But the variability, of course, due to the weather and things along the year and the markets. You guys do a great job, but I'm just not sure. Are we, you know, are we in the way? Are we, is the policy what it should be to take on an appropriate amount of risk for our customers? You think on too much or too little? I have no idea.
Well, that's what I was saying, that Ann reminded us that, reminded us that it really needs to have a more whole.
Yes, yeah.
There's
yeah.
so many other factors. And I do know that the team that works on this, they're really smart people, because it's complex.
I'll just invite my boss up to
okay.
say a few comments here.
I'm sorry I let us down this path.
No, this is an important subject.
Good morning again, commissioners. I would just like to add a little bit of context in that we are in a very good situation. We have a lot of electricity to sell, and it is worth a lot of money right now. I mean, probably double what it was worth a couple years ago. This is a good thing. It means that we can budget additional revenues and have, you know, some savings for our ratepayers, which really couldn't be a better time given the cost of everything else in the utility right now. That said, what we're trying to hedge is the risk that those prices could come back down. They doubled in the last year. Certainly, they could drop in half in the next year. So the numbers that Peter had cited, we are going out and trying to lock in some of these prices while they're good. I think the number was $44 million in sales on our book now compared to 24, 25 a year ago. So we're trying to secure that money, trying to make sure that we have it and we actually meet our budget in the future. To your question, Commissioner, I think we're okay. The policy is good. The policy is encouraging us to go out and make those sales and lock it in, even if it's maybe a little earlier than we normally would. Yes.
Yeah.
And we have many tools in our toolbox.
Yeah.
We've been using the easiest tools, just going out and making sales, but to hedge risk, we could purchase options. Market on that isn't as cheap or deep as we wish it was, but they are available. We could budget more conservatively, but we don't want to do that. We want to budget accurately.
Right.
And we could carry additional reserves to hedge against some of this. None of those are really options that we love. Making sales is the easiest one, so that's what we've been doing.
Yeah.
I feel like we're in a pretty good spot.
Thank you.
Shall we carry on?
Yes.
So just a couple more slides here. Crystal ball looking forward at prices over the winter and over calendar 23. So we're just looking at winter Q4. Left-hand side, see both prices and volatilities. Prices have been around $60 on average per megawatt hour up until about March of this year, and then all the way up until now, we've seen some kind of steady increases in prices as well as some volatility through that. So right now, winter prices are looking at about $100 a megawatt hour. Looking at calendar 23, so interestingly, this would be heavy load prices, so daytime prices. We have seen a similar sort of rise in prices starting around March. Calendar 23 prices are at about $100 a megawatt hour. That'd be for, you know, quite a bit, quite a large span of time there. Some of the pieces that we might buy or sell. So we have seen continued elevated prices. When we look out at the price forecasts, we can expect is slight prices moving forward for the horizon that we've got in the ERMC, or in the
Just here.
Any further questions?
This is a very minute question, but when you talk about Cal 24, is that the year?
That means January 1, 2024 through December 31st, 2024.
Okay, so, and so Cal 24.
So what that would mean is if we had a, say, some additional power that we wanted to sell on the market, we would be selling in each one of the periods, so pretty much every day, as well as 6 days of the week for heavy load for the whole year. So that's what it would mean. And that's what the prices that I was showing you
okay.
for that.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter and Brian. And congratulations again on your doctorate, Peter. That's awesome. Now we have Mike Shapley with the water supply update.
By the way, not necessarily this board, but previous boards have put you guys through the ringer in terms of bringing this information forward to us. And I like this one a lot.
I can imagine during Enron, all this was much more passionate conversation.
I did tend to bring that up. Because I was partially responsible for something that was less valuable to the board. All right.
Morning, commissioners. Mike Shapley. I am the district's short-term power trader, which means that I will buy and sell power anything from next day, like I did this morning, which was for Tuesday, starting at midnight up until about 2.5 years out to the extent of our risk management portfolio. And today I'm here to give you an update. It's been a while, as Peter mentioned. January is the last time we met. And so the timing is perfect. Water year 22 has just concluded on Friday, September 30th. So we're in a new water year, which is water year 13. So we'll first of all, just briefly look at our PUD energy mix, and this will be 2021 totals. And then we'll look at the summary of water year 22, as well as the forecast for this coming water year. This will be a very brief update. And so any questions you have, please feel free, but I wanted to really kind of pare it down just to the necessities here. So here's our 2021 supply mix. You can see that roughly 81% of our portfolio relies on water supply, hydroelectric generation. And so very important that we try to nail our water supply forecast as best we can. 2021, by the way, was a lower than average water year. If I recall, it was 86% of average. I think I have got it written down here. 81% of average.
What are the purchases 10.8? I know the decision was made to intentionally go that route to buy more of the market, right? The board made that.
I think, and this is just a reflection really of the fact that we didn't get as much water and slice generation that we would have normally expected.
Yeah.
So, right, you're going to be in the market purchasing more.
This is going to seem like a repeat, but I still don't understand why conservation and energy efficiency are not part of the portfolio mix.
I can't explain directly. I think it's very, very small, and it might even be there in the others renewables there. Marie Morrison would be a better one to ask that for sure.
Happy to hop in, Mike.
I feel sure. Like I should apologize, but.
No, I think Commissioner Wolf, if I could add, but this is Ann Spanberg again, General Counsel. What you're seeing is what we're using to meet load. When you look at our plans for how we are looking forward in the integrated resource plan, you do see acquisition of conservation is one of our most important methods for meeting future load growth. So you're not seeing it as part of these presentations because we're carving them up into pieces. So I don't know if that's helpful.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
it's helpful.
I do feel as though that they're just focusing.
I look at the 0.30% other renewables, and I think that's not energy efficiency. And that's not conservation. So that seems like that should be, and it has a major focus of ours.
It is, and I think, as I said,
basket.
This is the supply side part of our portfolio and doesn't include the reducing demand side of our portfolio.
So I guess I want to see how they balance.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know whether we could.
I think about it a lot. I'm sorry.
But we do see, Commissioner, in other types of reports, you'll see a number or a slide without conservation and one with conservation, which is a more accurate picture of the role that conservation is making in reducing our peaks.
Right.
Is that?
Yeah. And I hear your concern about wanting to see the more complete picture. So that's an interesting suggestion. We'll get to the team.
I'll just pop in really quick. This is Garrison Marr, the senior manager of Power Supply, and just a couple quick things. So, you know, the first one is a lot of these charts and the way that we communicate what our supply looks like, those formulas are given to us by other entities. So we're reacting to some of, you know, what those guidelines look like. So our fuel mix is a good example of that. That formula is given by the Washington State Department of Commerce. But the other thing I just wanted to point out really quickly is, you know, conservation really is in there, but it's hidden. You know, it's the hidden hero in the graph, which is that, you know, these portfolio mixes, as we describe them in all of our filings, are really always set to retail load. And what we know is that our retail load is lower because of conservation. And because these other parts of our portfolio do not move up and down in response to load, what that really means is that our market purchase, part of that pie shape, that would be higher if we didn't do the volume of conservation. So I would say that it is in here. It's not direct because the agencies that ask us to put these reports together ask for it in a special way, but we know what part of that pie chart would move. And we know that conservation is kind of the hidden hero here, keeping those costs down for us. I hope that's helpful.
It does. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Garrison. Okay, next, what we'll look at is what water year 22 brought to us. First, the big map there, if you remember, that is our water supply basin, the Northwest River Forecast Center water supply basin. And what this is just showing us is just about the complete of the water year, which is the 30th of September. This map is through the 25th. You can see the different colors are just representing the percent of 30-year average. So anything in red and orange is going to be below average, 50 to 70% or 50 to even below 50%. If you see green and blue, you're going to see something that's going to represent something at or above average. One thing that stands out pretty prominently, and it usually does, here on the West Coast, you see that in particular our area, Jackson had a really good generating year, as well as our other small hydro resources, quite a bit of blue and dark green along that area. So we were quite lucky. And in this particular slide, you can see in the southern portion of the basin, some orange more dramatically than you would see in the northern and west side. And that's pretty typical of what we've seen over the past really 5 to 7 years, when we've seen conditions that are representative of La Nina type of conditions, where you usually are having conditions that are wetter in most cases and cooler to the north, and to the south you usually have conditions that are drier and warmer.
So it doesn't seem like it rained in July to September. So is that just how we manage Jackson? The reservoir was high going into those months?
Right. That's a great question, because there are not just generation that comes out of Jackson, right? It's a lot of the biological recreation license limits that we have as well. So, right, we knew that everything told us hold on to that reservoir as much as you can. And we really had to, because in the months of April and May, it was still locked up there in snow. And so we were really generating low. But once we got into the month of June, we still kept generation really low because everything was telling us July and August was much more valuable. It turned out really nice for us.
So I have a question. You said that our smaller hydro are doing very well, but Hancock, Callaghan, and Youngs Creek are not doing anything, are they?
That's a good point.
Paid about $60 million at least for those Hancock and Callaghan, and I don't think we're getting good return on that investment yet. And I don't know how we will, given the seasonal flows. You know, too little when we need it, too much when we don't.
It's run of river, so you get it when it comes and you don't. And one of the unforeseen things that happened there, as well as we had a disruption in the transmission connection in Puget Sound Energy and then supply chain issues. So it has been offline, I think I put there, since mid-May.
March.
Yeah. And so finally, we've got that back up and running. And once we get some precipitation, we will start generating with both of those units.
Thanks.
But and Commissioner Logan, you're right. Although you generally don't get a ton of precipitation, July, August, and September, it was way below average. 10, 5, 15, maybe 30% of average. So yeah, very dry. So we talked about Jackson Hydro, 119% of average July 21 through June 22. They have a slightly different take on what the water year is, but July through September as well, 129% of average. So we were able to hold onto that water for the markets that were much better. As Peter mentioned, they had some really nice surplus sales during that period of time. Okay, and then next, I just wanted to show you, and this really dovetails nicely into what Peter was showing in terms of our net purchases for some of the months. So mostly during the beginning of the water year, this is just a chart of the water supply volumes. Doesn't necessarily mean generation, but in this particular case, it follows it very closely. But during the period of October through March of this past year, we had generation that was roughly about average of what we would expect through the winter time. And once we got into the months of April and May, because it was so darn cold, and we saw that we made some purchases, all that generation and water was still locked up behind the hydroelectric facilities. We were caught a little bit short. We had to buy back some of those forward sales that we made, but then it was to the benefit of the months of June, July, and August, where prices were much higher and the volume of generation that we got was significantly higher too. So we say it's an above average water year, 103% of average. Again, Peter showed some of the variation in generation that we get during those periods of specifically February through the months of April or even May. That although you have a water year that might be right near average, it's quite variable between each month. So that's how water year 22 ended up. And California, you've probably heard, has been quite the story. Particular Lake Mead is significantly below its full point, 185 feet, I think is what I heard. And they're finding all kinds of relics in that reservoir that they haven't seen. So California has been suffering. Only has 70% of average in terms of water supply in the dams. But what I've also read and I remember is that the last good water year they had was 2017. So it's been a while. They suffered through some drought. Fortunately, of course, they don't rely on hydroelectricity very much, but it certainly is helpful for the crops and everything else. And then lastly, the water year 23 winter forecast, since that's really our next horizon, we're still looking at La Nina conditions, which, as I mentioned, in most cases, historically, will produce wetter and cooler conditions in the north and drier and warmer conditions to the south. And this is all based on sea surface temperature anomalies in the equatorial Pacific. That's how they measure these seasons of La Nina and El Nino. And then in the Northwest Water Supply Basin, we've had above average water supply in water years that we've had La Nina, last 3 out of 4. I do need to make one correction. 2020, we need to mark out and add 2022. So 2020 was a La Nada or non-La Nina or non-El Nino. So it was just one of those neutral conditions that was neither. So we're optimistic about the upcoming water year. October, as of 2 weeks ago, looked like it was going to be a nice start to the water year with lots of precipitation. That doesn't look like it anymore. Looks like at least for the next 2 weeks, it's still going to be dry. Usually when things open up, it happens pretty rapidly. And that's all I had.
Thank you. Commissioners, I would like to propose a 5-minute break. Would you agree to that?
If we can do it.
Okay, so we will recess until 10:37.